Generally, when rabbis tell Hasidic stories, they tell stories that happened to someone else. But I would like to tell you a Hasidic story that happened to me. My wife, Ilana, is not only a federal prosecutor, but she is one of the world's best homemakers. And so Shabbat in our home is always an island of calm, which reflects her long and careful preparation so that nothing is left out and no detail overlooked. Except occasionally. And on those very rare occasions, I'm the one that's sent out to hustle through the neighborhood to try to find challah or kosher wine or some kind of dessert or whatever it is that somehow got overlooked in all the preparations. This almost never happens. Right, Ilana? But one Friday afternoon, I was sent out to pick up wine or challah or dessert or something. And as I'm walking out of the kosher store, there's some street person who comes up to me and holds out his hand and he says, "Tzedakah for Shabbos." In my neighborhood, street people are all Ashkenazim. So, tzedakah for Shabbos. I'm busy. I've got to get the wine. I've got to pick up the dessert. I need to make sure we have enough challahs. Shabbos is coming in. I don't have time for this. But I reach into my pocket. I take out my wallet. I hand him some money. And he takes it and walks over to another street person, hands him my money, and says, "Tzedakah for Shabbos." So I say to him, "You just took my money and gave it to that guy as tzedakah." And he looked at me and he said, "Yes, I need to give tzedakah for Shabbos." Now, I tell you this story not to let you know that I get visited by the prophet Elijah from time to time, but because he was right. He was right both in his understanding of Jewish law. In fact, no matter how poor you are required to give. But he's also right emotionally, that being a human means having the need to give to others. It means not only receiving, but also caring. And I want to raise that issue because this has been an unusually challenging and difficult year. On every possible level, we have faced challenges. Many of us are unemployed, who never thought we would be unemployed. Many of us have lost our homes, who never thought that that would ever happen. Some of us who still have homes and jobs do so with a sense of trepidation, a sense that what we have and who we are is in jeopardy. In addition to the economic ravages that have buffeted our community, the nation, and the world, we have watched the enemies of Israel assault Israel's reputation again and again throughout the year. We have watched as Israel's introspection has caused it pain and agony in difficult times when it continues to be threatened. We have seen Israeli politicians and American politicians vying for who can be most corrupt, who can be caught quickest, who can be sentenced first. And as we watch our leaders collapse in iniquity, we watch the economic challenges that continue to roil the world. We also have erupted in an inability to conduct civil debate, as people across party lines are only able to hurl invectives at each other, illegitimizing each other's humanity rather than wrestling with each other's wisdom,
and each other's insights. This, on top of the nuclear threat posed by Iran, this, on top of terror, on top of ongoing poverty, drug abuse, the list goes on and on and on. In a year of such stress, such challenge, such assault, what is a Jew to do? And here I take comfort from the fact that Rosh Hashanah is about new beginnings, about the reality that we are not trapped by the choices that we or others have made in the past, that we bear with us the constant ability to choose fresh, to choose anew, to make a different future based on what we choose now. The prophet Zechariah asked a question for all of us. Ki mivaz l'yom ktanot? Who would dare to scorn small beginnings? And so, as we stand here at what could be a new and small earth-changing beginning, it's time to return home. And home for Jews is Torah. So I want to remind you of two basic core stories upon which the entire Torah constitutes an elucidation. The Torah begins with the remarkable story of the one unifying power in the cosmos erupting into creation without having to. God doesn't need the world. God doesn't need creation, except for God to be loving, there must be an object upon which God can pour the love. And so God creates a world unrequired to be able to shower love undeserved. And we, I remind you, are made in God's image. We are most ourselves, which is to say most godlike, when we also are finding those upon whom we can shower love and compassion and nurture. In a sense, the rest of Jewish tradition is simply a riff on that first story. But the Torah then weighs in with a second earth-shattering story. And that story is that the same God who loves without desert, that God who showers us with compassion and chesed and rachamim, that God also weighs in on behalf of a small and oppressed people against the mighty Pharaoh. And so it was as we marched out to freedom, and we have been telling that story ever since, God has continually weighed in against the pharaohs of every age. The path is not straight. The innocent are not let off. But eventually, the pharaohs come crashing down. Time and again, they have correctly understood that the proper language of freedom is Hebrew. And that we have been calling out, let my people go, from our inception in antiquity. And Pharaoh, after Caesar, after Hitler, after Brezhnev, all of them have hurled themselves against our people, and every one of them has failed. At great, great suffering and cost to us and to billions of others. But the universe inclines toward freedom. And the Torah reminds us that God's two core traits are to love undeservedly and to align yourself with liberation. This requires of us then an agenda of hope and of preparation. The Torah tells another story, a story of a Yosef, a man who had 7 years to help a different pharaoh prepare during good times for 7 years of challenging times. We are the anti-Yosef. We find ourselves in the difficult times, and the choices that we make today and this year will shape how we reemerge into the light of good times that will come. And so we must be mindful of the impact of our choices, and we must now be thinking with hope and with courage and with strength about the good days ahead and what we need to do now to make them happen. The theologian Franz Rosenzweig wrote, "At each moment, the future presents to man the gift of being present to himself. And so, man may use his moments freely and then deposit them in the vast receptacle of the past. In the enduring process of receiving and using his moments, he is truly human, master of the present, of his present, for it is truly his if he is present." This day is an invitation to be present, to wake up, to attend to life, to not let the busyness, the exhaustion, be an excuse for a lack of attention, a lack of follow-through. I am here today to remind you that there are many yardsticks for wealth. And I say that, and I wish to tell you up front, I am fully in favor of the conventional yardstick of wealth. Money is fine with me. In fact, I think of my rabbinate as a modern-day Robin Hood. My job is to take from the rich and give to the rabbinical students. So I'm all in favor of wealth and money. But I am here to remind you today that there are other forms of wealth, and that in times when money is short, we need to remember the other blessings of abundance that give our life meaning and that ultimately make our efforts worthwhile. If you are sitting next to someone who will hold your hand, then you possess a great wealth. If you have the ability to take time and to enjoy your time, you have an extraordinary wealth. 99.9% of the matter that constitutes the universe will never savor time. And you are that rare 0.001% of matter that is able to say, "It's nice to be sitting here." That's a great wealth. If while you are savoring your loved ones and your time, you're able to enjoy an inner life, song, poetry, meditation, a nap now and then, that is a great wealth, and you should cherish it. Relationships of love and of caring, the ability to use your mind to learn, to master something you previously were not able to attain, to be able to think a thought you never would have thought before. These are all great harvests of wealth. And not least, the capacity to give. My son Jacob, you've heard me speak about before, a now 17-year-old boy who struggles with autism. And one of Jacob's favorite activities is the friendship circle, in which allegedly typical teenagers, although I've never met a really typical teenager, but teenagers who think of themselves as typical meet with special needs teenagers once a week to be their buddies. Jacob has a wonderful, wonderful buddy who's actually a member of Sinai Temple, who's been visiting with him for the last 3 years. And Jacob has commented not just on this buddy, but on the whole program, that generally it's the typical kids who think that they are the benefactors, and who think that it's the special needs kids who are the recipients. But Jacob says all they're doing is some public service credit, which they do through me. But what I give them is a reminder of what's really important in life. So who's really the beneficiary, he says. The capacity to give is not limited to the ability to pay. You can give without money, by smiling, by hugging, by offering the gift of conversation or companionship. You give gifts that money cannot buy. So even in these difficult times, we possess more wealth than we know what to do with, and we ignore it at our own peril. I remind you, crossing party lines for a moment, that two of our great recent presidents, President Ronald Reagan and President Bill Clinton, differed in their policy programs, but what they both shared in common was that when you were in their presence, no matter how bad things seemed to be outside, you were in the presence of resilient calm and hope. In difficult times, we, like they, can offer each other hope and calm and strength. An anonymous poet wrote the following words: "The gods we worship write their names on our faces, be sure of that. And you will worship something, have no doubt about that either. You may think that your tribute is paid in secret, in the dark recesses of your heart, but it will out. That which dominates our imagination and our thoughts will determine our life and character. Therefore, it behooves us to be careful what we worship, for what we worship, we become." On this Rosh Hashanah, 5,770, I urge you to worship hope. I urge you to worship faith. I urge you to worship love and justice. Because in so doing, you will become those things. You will be so hopeful that the hope that you shine into the world will inspire others, and together we will turn around these difficult times. You will be so rooted in faith, Shatul Bevet Adonai, that you will flower and blossom in ways that will allow the United States and Israel to remain strong beacons of freedom and democracy, inspiring people everywhere and strengthening our people. You can become love and understand that love is not some flimsy emotion that comes and goes. Love is ultimately the cosmos's most powerful force. If it is determined, if it is resilient, if it will not back down in the face of resistance. Love, we are told in the Tanakh, is stronger even than death. So let us, for God's sake, become loving. And let us understand that the implementation of love in the world is compassion on a human level and justice among peoples. So let us reach out to other individuals here and abroad with compassion, and let us fight for justice. in Los Angeles, in California, in North America, and across the world. Our God launched the world by loving beyond requirement and by setting poor slaves free. I invite you to rise to your godlike nature, to love unreservedly, and to reach out to the widow and the orphan, and to lift them up. Shana Tova.